And we're rolling. Hey, this is Mark. Hello, Matthew.
How are you doing, Mark? It's Matthew Lee from Inner City Press, inside the United Nations.
And Mark Goldberg with UNDispatch.com from my remote Washington, D.C. location.
It's not that remote. You may be in the center of the action there, Mark. So
this is the center of the universe, I will have you know. But the center of my universe, as you know, I'm a big fan of Susan Rice, the
sure.
incoming, the now United States ambassador to the UN, and she made her first appearance in Turtle Bay on Monday and presented her credentials to Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, after which she paused to take a few brief questions from the press.
Totally.
I assume you're a part of that.
I was part of the
press.
I was part of the gaggle, and I will say that it's her first day, and presumably she'll have some sit-down opportunities. She took three questions, and I will say, having been there part of the scrum, the mission made it its business to try to choose in advance who could ask the questions and what mm-hmm. the questions would be. A certain mission person was moving through the crowd saying, "It'd be good if you asked about Gaza," which was sort of obvious. But you know, basically, she she didn't get the Africa question. The mumbling in the press scrum is that someone should say to her, "Given your role during the Rwanda genocide, will you let it happen again in Darfur?"
But well, nobody there was actually. I read the transcript, and
go
there
ahead.
Was something saying, you know, like last time Democrats were in power Rwanda
right.
happened. So
that
what are you going
right.
to do to make sure?
It wasn't as pointed as those of us in the crowd.
It was kind of like a weirdly structured question.
And then
was
Richard Roth of CNN, by the way. I'll give him his props.
Okay.
He's not here every day anymore, but he was here that day. Did the transcript pick up that as she took her third question and left? The saying, one question on Somalia, was that left in the transcript?
I can't remember, but
she didn't take it.
Do you want credit for that, Matt?
She didn't take it. I didn't that's not me. That's yeah. that's Viku of the BBC Afrique, by the way.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I mean, I
didn't know. I can't remember if the transcript said that.
That's the sort of incongruous. In fact, we can parse over those three questions, although the answers were really pretty...
Well, one thing, actually, I wanted to parse.
Please.
Was her answer to the Darfur question, and she said,
ongoing genocide.
These are her words. Yeah, she used the term ongoing genocide.
Yep.
Ongoing genocide to describe Darfur. I don't know if she or if Obama had used that particular formulation before,
mm-hmm.
but I, you know, it was pretty shocking to me actually.
Were you surprised?
You know,
if Bush calls it genocide, why not her?
Well, you know, to call it an ongoing genocide, you know, to me would suggest that it is this sort of emergency that deserves, you know, the foremost attention, right? If you're calling it genocide mm-hmm. ongoing, you know, presumably that means that, you know, a genocide is happening as we speak.
The point I want to make
I haven't seen yet from the Obama administration are actions sort of commensurate to the to responding to a genocide that is ongoing. For
sure,
example,
sure.
Within 48 hours of taking office, Obama appointed Richard Holbrooke for Afghanistan and Pakistan, and George Mitchell for the Middle East. And clearly, these are, you know, two top tier American foreign policy priorities.
Sure.
It's clear from the fact that, you know, he didn't appoint a Sudan envoy in the same sort of sentence, in the same meeting, that maybe Sudan is not a top-tier American foreign policy priority.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, to me seems a bit incongruous
that you're not
going to make an ongoing genocide a top-tier American foreign policy priority. That said, it isn't a top-tier American foreign policy priority, which is why I'm curious as to why that formulation, that ongoing genocide formulation, was used.
Right, absolutely. I think people, first of all, I was going to just say, you know, maybe this means that Richard Williamson is still in the mix. You know, he was obviously the Bush administration's Sudan envoy. He sort of unceremoniously, where is he now, sort of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the reason that the shouted question was having to do with Somalia is that what's surprising is that the perception is that under Obama, and particularly Susan Rice, that Africa will be a much more prominent in U.S. foreign policy and and more of a priority at the UN. That's why people find it so incongruous. It may, strategically, from a totally sort of like dispassionate point of view, it may be true that Somalia is so bad that it can't support even a peacekeeping mission, but it seems like a very strange thing to wash your hands of. And I was going to say, you know, maybe for purposes of drawing you out, but in the last, you know, month, have more people been killed in Somalia or Sudan by conflict? Or we could throw in Sri Lanka. Now, why is Sri Lanka not a conflict? I mean, I'm not saying Sudan's not a major problem, but it was clear that that question was going to be asked, but it wasn't as clear why, you know, Somalia or obviously the Congo. We'll touch on all these things.
I mean, again, you know, in Rice's defense, she's been there for, we're recording this on Wednesday, been there for 2 days.
Correct.
And had one brief press availability. You know, presumably she'll expand on that more. And you know, at her congressional hearing, and her confirmation hearing, she did talk about Somalia. And I think she made the point that, you know, I like to make on UN Dispatch and that I think is made probably a consensus opinion among sort of the advocacy community, which is that, you know, we should not be pressing for peacekeepers in Somalia right now. It's sort of an unrealistic proposition to expect that peacekeepers will deploy anytime soon to a situation as unstable as Somalia. But
Mark, try me on this. This is just by a fluke. This very afternoon, I attended a press conference about the responsibility to protect and a civil society coalition that's forming around it. And I asked about Somalia, and people were like, well, you know, it seems like the proponents of responsibility to protect, of which I take you to be one, view the sort of the thing that rubs up against it is sovereignty. The idea is like, you know, you want to protect, but sometimes countries, you know, invoke sovereignty, and so can you go in or not? The irony is that the people of Somalia desperately need protection. There's not really anyone invoking sovereignty to stop it. There's just, does the world have either the courage or the commitment to go in and do it? But there's no... Whereas in several countries, Myanmar, where responsibility to protect was attempted to be invoked by the French, certainly in Sudan, these are all countries that have a strong central government, or a central government, forget strong for a moment, a central government very willing to say, we are sovereign, you know, you have no right to come in and protect our civilians from us. Whereas, like, the more I think about it, Somalia is like the perfect, it's an even simpler test of responsibility to protect. These people are screwed. They're living in an absolute, total anarchy. Right now, Al-Shabaab took over Baidoa. There's basically no more... Yeah. Right, the TFT, the putative.
That a little bit because I speak your language. I don't
okay,
know
absolutely.
All
the putative. Technically, yeah. The government of Somalia is called the Transitional Federal Government. It was set up in a somewhat murky UN-sponsored process, and is the entity which is represented at the UN. They still have a seat here. They're still talking. The only problem they don't have is they don't have a single seat in Somalia. They've effectively been chased out of their last stronghold, Baidoa, which they were installed in by Ethiopia and others. Ethiopia has pulled out its troops, let's not call them peacekeepers, and Al-Shabaab, which are described as the militant Islamist youth group, has taken over the last stronghold of the TFG. So it seems like, now it's true that, like, to go in, you might have to fight Al-Shabaab. In fact, you're pretty much on the record. But they're not making a claim of sovereignty. They're just making a claim of, like, they've got better, you know, rocket-propelled grenade launchers than you do. That's it.
Right.
And so it's strange. Yeah, I just think it's very strange that people that are such, not people, not here I'm not saying you. I found it so strange that it's almost like RTP, rather than being deployed on the basis of how many civilians are getting screwed and how can you help them, it's almost like a kind of a political argument to say, you're a bad government. Like, are we looking for the place where the people need protection and you could actually, at least legally speaking, no one in Somalia is going to tell you can't go in, right? The TFG would be happy for anyone to go in because they're not even there. So, I don't know if you see it. To me, it seems incongruous.
I guess I don't see the incongruity, but, you know, because the whole point of R2P, the responsibility to protect, was to you know, pierce the shield of state sovereignty, right? Was to make sovereignty a less viable defense. If you know, that with sovereignty comes responsibilities that you have to protect your own citizens, and if you can't do it, the international community will. The problem with Somalia is not that there is, you know, is not an issue of sovereignty. It's a matter of international will. There's simply not no country is willing to launch an invading force on in Somalia. The one country that did, Ethiopia,
sure.
Did to sort of install a puppet regime of the international community and was not accompanied by a viable sort of political process.
But is it fair then to say that RTP is more of an ideological concept than a humanitarian concept? Because if it was based on, I'm going out of my way to say it controversially, but I'm thinking now of this press conference and writing something about it, and it seems to me
I think it's like beyond ideological or humanitarian. It's sort of a legal precept. It is now sort of an established. It's part of sort of the sort of international law.
So it's what you deploy if the wrongdoer is a government. Then you deploy RTP to say, we have a right to stop you. But if the people are getting screwed by a non-state actor like al-Shabaab, there's nothing to deploy, and you're not interested in going in if you're the U.S. You're not as interested in going into Somalia as Sudan, because in Sudan you can make a political point while you go in, whereas in Somalia there's no point to make, so why go in? I mean, I'm...
And the political point that you're trying to make in Sudan, presumably,
is that an Islamist government has been committing a genocide, and we're going to stop you. And that that historically, this same Islamist government went after Christians in the south, and they're just all around bad guys. Whereas al-Shabaab may be bad. I mean, I don't know. I'm wondering.
Al-Shabaab, right? They're terrorists.
I know they are.
According to the statement, I mean, there are political arguments to make about their
patriots.
Undesirability. You can make sort of the argument of that sort of it's in American national interest to stabilize Somalia because of the piracy issues going on. Because no one gives a flying rat's.
Right.
Shit.
No, exactly. I mean, maybe the RTP thing is the wrong thing to argue about, but I just think.
It's a matter of international law. No one really cares that much about Somalia. There's no oil there. There's no natural resources there. There's nothing really there. And the last time, the last time America tried something in Somalia, it ended in pretty horrible failure.
But I guess
so there's. There's a lot going against Somalia. Which has not had a government in. What is it, like 14 years?
Right.
It's been without a central government.
Sure. It goes back to like 91, so it's been quite a while. I just want to nail this down. It seems to me that RTP is more, it's more about the identity of the wrongdoer than of the victim. RTP is not a principle that no person on earth should face these four crimes, crimes against humanity, war crimes, genocide or ethnic cleansing, and if they do, the world community will help them. It really is, it's these four crimes shouldn't be committed by a government, that it's that we want to stop or target in some way.
Well,
right?
There's no need to invoke R2P in the Somalia situation because no one is holding up Somali sovereignty as an excuse.
So RTP is an argument.
Is like a strictly legal recourse.
But
right?
what these guys were saying, if
the government of Myanmar, for example, is committing genocide on its own population. Before R2P happened, the Security Council, the UN is defined, like the founding principle of the UN is state sovereignty, right? Mm-hmm. And the inviolability of state sovereignty. Now, with R2P, there is the Security Council can revoke state sovereignty, right?
Mm-hmm.
They can argue that, we have this legal principle that we can use to justify our intervention, to justify invading and occupying you guys.
So I totally misunderstood this thing that I went to today, then, Mark, because it seemed like this was the kind of thing you could put on a T-shirt, like RTP. It seemed much more like a populist movement than a legal argument.
Well, it has support among people like me, and people that are human rights activists and all that, because it was.
Do you have an RTP
T-shirt?
It's
like a stunning development in the history of the Westphalian system, right? It's a really big deal because
I thought that was a kind of ham. Isn't that a kind
which,
of ham?
What's West, that?
Isn't that a kind of ham?
Westphalian ham. I don't know. I'm Jewish.
I'm sorry.
I don't eat ham.
I'm just joking. Yeah. If you don't mind, because I understand. Another irony strikes me, which is that. In a sense, you have the many debates at the UN about terrorism. There was a victims of terrorism event in September in which a number of Arab states and Arab journalists raised questions because no victims of Israel, we'll get to Gaza in a moment, were testifying. So the idea was, how can you, that the working definition of terrorism, which they described as a sort of a Western definition, said that terrorism is only committed by non-state actors and not by the government. Right? So there's something, it almost seems strange that you then have this, I mean, not strange, I'm just sort of thinking this one out. Like, the same groups, at least some of the ones in the Middle East that were saying that terrorism should include acts done by government, specifically Israel, are ones that are saying, it's sort of like you have, but they're saying that I mean, because there is opposition to RTP, obviously, right? The UN's Office of Responsibility to Protect has not actually been formed, because the General Assembly said we never agreed to this.
Mm-hmm. No, in 2005
they agreed to it, but they didn't agree to the specifics of setting up an office. And I guarantee you, it was confirmed to me today, Ed Luck's title is not Special Advisor on RTP. This was taken away, and he's back this is getting a little inside baseball, but he's the UN Special Advisor on the topic. So there remains a controversy here. And what's strange is, I guess all I'm pointing out is the overlap of countries that in a way are want to include governments as possible perpetrators of terrorism in the case of Israel, right? But that are very concerned about a sort of an uncontrolled development of RTP that could end up targeting their governments as wrongdoers. So I don't know. I'm not actually sure what the relationship between the terrorism debate and RTP is, but there is this overlap, and they're both kind of like these legal arguments about states and victims. I guess I would say about the RTP thing is the Somalia thing, I think, is the example, is sort of you look at it and you stare at it, because if it's about suffering people, the world would have done something. You know what I mean? Or at least wouldn't feel comfortable saying the time's not right to help those people. It's 16 freaking years.
I guess I just don't agree that if it's about suffering, then the world would have done something about it. I mean,
nothing can be done.
You know, well, no, it's not nothing can be done, is that no one wants to do anything meaningful about it.
That's exactly what I mean, is if the people cared, then they would do something, right? I mean,
so what sort of the world has done is sort of pawn this off on the UN. I mean, this is why, for example, just approving a UN peacekeeping mission is such a bad idea, right? Mm-hmm. It's that, you know, if member states, if the United States, if any P5 country just, you know, were to suggest the previous administration in their waning days were trying to try to get a peacekeeping mission authorized for Somalia. Mm-hmm. No, it's their way of saying that they're doing something about it. But having once authorized a peacekeeping mission to Somalia, it's clear that there's not political or military will to support the peacekeeping mission, to actually staff it, to give it the right number of troops, the right mandate, to back it up with diplomatic and political pressure. I mean, it's clear that that's just not happening. That's mm-hmm. why a peacekeeping mission, you know, it was just sort of
RTP means nothing.
Member states can say that they're doing something, right. but it would not have actually, they would not have followed through.
To me, I cannot take RTP seriously if the same, you know, I mean, obviously we're sort of generalizing here, but if the idea is, I mean, because if the idea is what gives you a right, and I'm in favor of that right, what gives the international community a right to go into Myanmar or go into wherever is the suffering of the people trumps everything, and so therefore sovereignty is out the window, suffering of the people, then you can't just say, well, this is a case where the people are suffering, but we're not committed to it. Then if you're not committed to it there, you can't be all high and mighty. I wish they were committed to it both places, but this is, to me, is what seems to be, it's not even an irony. It just doesn't, it makes it, going in shouldn't be a politicized act. It should be an act because it's like being a conscientious objector. If you're against war, you got to be against all wars, right, to invoke that principle. And I think in the same way, if you're going to say we're coming in for RTP, whether it's to Sudan or Myanmar, both of which I'm in favor of helping people there, you can't just say, here's this other case, the suffering is as great, but there we're not that interested. But over here, where the perpetrator is someone we don't like, we're very interested. That, to me, seems cynical and sleazy.
I think you're misunderstanding the sort of what R2P is. You know, it was discussed in the Myanmar case because there is a government of Myanmar that stakes a claim to sovereignty over the country Myanmar, right?
Right, but it'd be
and
like
it
saying,
was being and right. you know it was being discussed at the time as a way of getting around violating Burmese sovereignty. One way, so the legal way to get around
the question,
violating
if a cyclone
sovereignty.
Hit Somalia, would they not want to help?
Well, there no group stakes a claim to Somali sovereignty.
No, but I'm getting down to the bottom line of
to
like
Somali sovereignty. So you know, I'm just saying, like you can't use Somalia to criticize R2P because R2P exists as a legal recourse to. Around the idea of state sovereignty.
I'm not sure it's a legal argument. I'm
going to
call it a moral argument. I don't think it has enough
like
legal
traction.
Like, you can
call humanitarian
say,
intervention is right. the moral argument, but R2P sure. is the specific legal document
right.
that allows the Security Council, and only the Security Council, to suspend the to violate the sovereignty
but as we both know, it's
of
just
a UN member state.
It's a buzzword, but because even before that was passed in 2005, if none of the P5 wanted to veto, they could vote to do anything they want. They make their own laws, right? It's not, where's the court that tells the Security Council, ooh, absent RTP, you can't do that. They can do whatever they want. So it's a nice concept. I guess all I'm saying is that to actually implement it in the world, you have to have some moral force behind it. You have to say, here's why we're invoking it. We're invoking it because we reached the stage of human development in which suffering, you know, our concern for suffering leads us to ignore otherwise applicable legal principles like sovereignty. But if suffering is not what's moving the thing, if suffering in one place doesn't matter, whereas in another place it becomes of much concern, then it doesn't. You still have the legal argument, but I something is missing. You know. The salt has lost its flavor. I don't know. I think there's a relation. We can move past that. But it's the hype way to say it would be, it's sort of like if a cyclone hit Somalia and nobody came to help, that would be sad, right? Because the idea is that you're supposed to help people after a cyclone. You're not supposed to be particularly concerned about people after a cyclone because they're in a military dictatorship, which you've always wanted to overthrow. Like, at the moment of a cyclone, you're supposed to just care about people. I really believe that.
But you know, just again, to follow that example, if a cyclone hit Somalia, and, you know, there would be no... So the problem with Burma was that the Burmese, the Myanmar government...
I understand what you're saying. The
internationals into the country. There would be, in the Somalia case, there would be no one doing the not let it.
No,
right?
Exactly. But would that mean that no one would go and help? That's what I'm saying. Are humanitarians not gluttons for punishment, but gluttons for pushback?
People could have come and gone as right. they please. The problem with Myanmar, and the reason that R2P was being discussed at the time, was because the government of Myanmar did not want to let in.
Correct. No, I understand. I mean, I don't think...
And invoking R2P would have been a way to approve, to authorize the letting in of internationals, presumably
you don't
like
disagree
military
that,
intervention, in a way that doesn't violate international law.
But one is just a factual question. I'm not sure how much international aid went to Somalia to the degree that it was touched and it was by the tsunami. But the other thing is, I just want to say, I understand it's a legal principle, but I want to say, you don't disagree with the idea that the international community should be as concerned with the suffering of people, whether or not they're invoking RTP. It shouldn't be like, well, here's RTP, we really want to get into Myanmar, but if the same storm hits Somalia, where there's not a government pushing back and we really don't want to be there, we're just not that concerned with the people there. It should be like, here's a cyclone, you know?
Yeah, no, I agree.
Okay. I think I didn't think you'd disagree. There's something there, but we can. There's been. I will say that there's a group was thrown out of the UN based on terrorism charges. Maybe we can get into that.
Let's wait because before we get on, you're telling me that, and that sounded pretty interesting. So give us. I'm coming into this. Tabula rasa. I know nothing about what you're about to describe.
I'll do that. I feel that our viewership has asked for Gaza coverage, so we'll do that later. But I want to.
There's
it seems obscure, but it raises all of these same issues. There's non-governmental organizations, hereinafter NGOs, participate in the UN system. This was the great innovation of having civil society come in, and to participate, they are accredited. There's the Economic and Social Council, ECOSOC, has a special committee that considers applications by groups and accredits them, and then they're allowed into the building. They're given a special pass. They testify to the Human Rights Council. And you're in. And every few years you give a report. Most of these, I've been covering this whole week, actually more 10 days now. The committee's been meeting in the basement. And most days it's deathly boring, where they go over applications where the group is not there. There's no opposition. But lo and behold, there was an issue. And the issue was Algeria filing a complaint against an existing accredited member known as the Arab Commission for Human Rights. And the basis of their complaint was that in June 2008, Arab Commission for Human Rights, when they were called on to testify to the Human Rights Council on the Universal Periodic Review of Algeria, brought in another NGO, which is not accredited, which is known as Al-Karama, which means dignity in Arabic, and that the speaker who spoke on behalf of both Al-Karama and Arab Commission on Human Rights is one Rashid Mesli, who Algeria describes as a terrorist, and who Amnesty International, according to the U.S. mission, describes as a prisoner of conscience. He was tried for terrorism in 1999 in Algeria in a trial that Amnesty International said wasn't fair. He wasn't really convicted, but then they called him a supporter of terrorism. He left the country and was granted refugee status by Switzerland. In one description, he's a human rights activist. From Algeria's description, he is a revolutionary terrorist on the lam.
I'll cast my lot with Amnesty International and Swiss refugee.
And you know who doesn't join you in that one is the UK, Romania, Israel. There was a vote, so self-interestedly, in covering it for 10 days, I said it seemed obvious that the complaint should be released, but it wasn't. Neither Algeria nor the committee wanted to release the complaint, nor did the U.S. mission, for what it's worth, at least initially. Which I found strange, and then was later explained to me is since there was the transition between Khalilzad and Susan Rice, or viewed bigger, you know, Bush and Obama, they just didn't know what to do. But I will say that as maybe I expect too much, but it seems like the one drum that the U.S. mission has beaten, and I hope will continue to beat, is like transparency. Like if a group is being, if somebody's being charged, it should be released. Ultimately, I got it, and there's like all. The whole argument came down to, and this is why I think it's, although it's at a lower level, it's related to what we were talking about, is whether governments here at the UN should just accept the word of another member state at face value. Cuba, Egypt, many countries spoke and said, hey, if Algeria says that they're terrorists, it's good enough for me. And we shouldn't get into second-guessing Algeria. We shouldn't, as a committee, ask for any more information. They're a member state. It's sort of like the UN as a club of, you know, you could say dictatorships, whatever it is. Like, this guy is clearly viewed as an enemy by the government of Algeria. There's no question. So the question is, it's almost like, should governments back each other up and say, okay, we'll bar your dissident if you bar our dissident, right? And this is the way it went. And the thing is that it was, there were all these procedural things and you know, there was at least initially it seemed like it was going to be delayed to get more information on, like, is the guy a terrorist or not. Switzerland came and said, we gave him refugee status. Algeria said, that's irrelevant. You know, I talked to the Sudanese. They were like, Sudan is chairing this committee, by the way, as they are now chairing the group of 77 as well. So they were like, with some glee, like, this group's going to get excluded. And those are the arguments. After 10 days and much delay and a secret meeting that I got described, but you know, nobody from the press republic could attend in an open meeting today by a vote of 18 in favor, none against, and one abstention, the group, Arab Commission for Human Rights, was suspended for a year and told that it must turn over its whole list of members and associates in order to be reinstated. What do you think, Mark?
I mean, it sounds like a miscarriage of justice to me, right? I mean, it doesn't, like, yeah. Again, I can't comment on the specifics of the case of the guy, but it seems, you know, and there have been problems, right, with more broadly with this accreditation process in the past, because
sure.
A few groups I've recall reading gay and lesbian rights groups been barred, right? By
there's one getting barred right now, actually, from Brazil. There was a, as I left just now today, the committee, there was a series of questions raised by Qatar about whether this Brazilian gay and lesbian organization is involved in pedophilia. And
right.
Until those
questions are answered.
The big,
yeah, I remember right. That's like, you know, typically, you know, conservative Arab countries raise problems when gay and lesbian rights groups try to seek their accreditation at the in the NGO status.
But the
so
US,
I don't, it
right.
seems like there's something faulty with the system in general, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It says like
to means, me at least, right. I'm generally disposed to giving the secretariat itself more power, and maybe presumably one thing that they might do and they might wish to do is do their own accrediting,
right sort of like,
I mean,
the media
presumably
is
like, well, presumably the member states would oppose that because they want to have control over the process, but you know, it just seems almost like a no-brainer that the secretariat should be able to do this kind of thing.
What jumps out to me is that, because I suddenly thought of it, why, but you know, member states don't control, for example, media accreditation to the UN,
yeah.
right? If
yeah,
they did,
so.
That would be very interesting. You'd have arguments about, you know, many more arguments. No, I agree, but I do want to say, as I know that I finally zeroed it down. You're not a defender of the Security Council. You're not a defender of the General Assembly. But I think you're a defender of the Secretariat and the sort of the idea behind the UN. And I am too, but I will say in this case, the very secretariat, the committee is staffed by, and the document was filed with, the secretariat. It's an entity run by the Department of Economic and Social Affairs, DESA. And I spoke three times this week to the UN employed staffer of the committee saying, shouldn't this document, the complaint, be released? And her answer was, no, if you report on it now, it'll just scare people and be misleading. And I was like, well, you know, it's nice, I appreciate your advice on how to report, but the question is, at the UN, is a document like this public or not?
Well, and I mean, listen, like, the group might have a UN staffer, but that staffer doesn't have any authority to grant or deny people.
Well, I think
or
if they hold
NGOs,
it,
I mean, right?
No, I'm saying the release of the document. I'm just talking very, very simply. Do you believe that the UN Secretariat, as a world body and as an entity that should be above board and transparent, should a document that's filed with it should be able to release it? Rather than keep
it confidential. What's the document you're talking
about? The Algeria's complaint. Because people kept saying, well, Algeria's filed this complaint. Egypt described it as an extensive complaint. When I finally got it, it's 8 pages. And really all it is a 2-page letter from Algeria and an Algerian verdict saying, guilty, guilty, guilty. Mm-hmm. That's it. You know, so I agree. Some of the countries were very honest. They were like, this basically just comes down to... And it was. Here's what I thought was strange. The Indian... delegate today said, you know, it's not for us to second guess Algeria. It's a member state, and its verdicts have to be respected. And it struck me, and I know that this will cause this may cause some trouble here, at least saying this. But like, if a Pakistani court suddenly cleared those alleged to be involved in the bombing of Mumbai, I don't think India would respect it. So it seems like a ludicrous argument to say that any legal decision by any member state must be respected, right? Because logic, the U.S. could say, we can vet Fidel Castro. He's a terrorist. Does Cuba have to respect that? You know what I mean? Like, I know that they don't like to open up the can of worms and having sort of like big Western powers, you know, second-guessing. But you do, there is, despite, you know, this, I mean, this is why I say it's related to the first thing we discussed. It's not sovereignty. This is like how much respect is due a member state just because it's a member state, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, are there ludicrous legal decisions? Apparently there are, you know? And I don't.
Yeah.
It just seemed really. It seemed strange because the same countries that were like wanting to support this principle of like, you know, if it's done by a member state, it must be right. They could be, you know, hoisted on that same petard if Nehru started holding, you know, war crimes tribunals against their leaders. I mean, they're a member state, right? So I guess maybe the principle is that you can do whatever you want to your own citizens, which is why we get back to RTP again. You see what I mean? Anyway, I'm in a
full circle. Full circle.
I'm in a full philosophical mood over here, but that was something. That's all I can say.
Yeah. So maybe we can move on to updates on the Gaza situation.
We can. I'll try to, rather than, because I figure that our viewers can they're free to get the sort of like basic news of the ceasefire themselves. I want to try to engage you in I'll attack UNRWA and you'll defend it. Do you see what I'm saying? And I like UNRWA, by the way. They've been doing great briefings, but I've come to believe that they have a blind spot. Despite and this is maybe it's and everybody has a blind spot, but here's their blind spot. Their blind spot is they what was their blind
so,
spot?
So you should actually okay. UNRWA is the was the UN
Relief and Works Agency.
Works
that's
agency
that's been around. It deals with Palestinian refugees. So it deals with them both in Lebanon. It's in the West Bank. It's in Jordan.
It's like the Palestinian refugee humanitarian
arm of the UN. Absolutely, and they do. They have 10,000 staffers.
Shoot.
They're in Gaza. During the fighting. I mean, I have to there's a lot of they were the
well,
ones
we
who
talked
ran,
about last time the
school that got bombed
of the Israeli targeting of
sure.
UNRWA.
No, no, absolutely. So I mean,
you're about to set me up. It sounded.
Yeah,
like.
I think so. Absolutely. I'm going to go out again. The 10,000 national staff that they have, they're the ones really doing work there. So all of that is above board. At the same time, obviously, they became a sort of an, especially because Israel didn't allow reporters in, UNRWA became one of the few information sources. Right,
mm-hmm.
other than Hamas, for
yeah.
what was happening in the Gaza Strip, and they and at least in the first days of the offensive, they did a kind of a yeoman job. They did briefings every day. They were accused, I think, they were seen as being somehow too harsh on Israel. But obviously, if you're in the Gaza Strip and bombs are going off around you, who are you going to blame, right?
And on top of you.
But the weird part is this, is that is although I've heard some people sort of from a Zionist perspective accuse UNRWA of being in bed with Hamas because they're still there in Gaza and presumably talk with Hamas, I've come to believe that they're not. And not only are they not, they, like the UN system as a whole and like the EU, want so much for the, quote, Palestinian Authority, otherwise known as Fatah, otherwise known sometimes as the PLO, but the group that's still in charge of the West Bank but has no, really may have supporters but no governmental power in the Gaza Strip. Mm-hmm. Everyone wants them somehow to re-establish, when I say everyone, I mean the EU, but it looks like the U.S., it looks like the U.N., even on the humanitarian front, does as well. Here's, I'll tell you a factual story and you tell me what you think of it. The story is as follows. A girl, and it's very specific, it's a girl whose leg and some organs were crushed during this assault by a bomb. It's in Shifa Hospital in Gaza City. A French NGO has offered to perform an operation on her if she can just get to France. They put her in an ambulance and they drive her to the Rafah crossing between the Gaza Strip and Egypt. And whereupon she's told the Palestinian Authority's health ministry in Ramallah, in the West Bank, has said that it's no longer necessary to spirit children out of the Gaza Strip for medical service elsewhere. Seems very strange and heartless, but this was not only in, like, there's a newspaper called The National that comes out of the UAE. It was also on Al Jazeera Arabic service. It seems pretty clear this happened. And then the question becomes, well, why? And what people seem to say is that the Palestinian Authority in Ramallah doesn't have power in the Gaza Strip, right? It's here speaking at the UN in favor of, on behalf of all Palestinians, but it actually only controls, you know, it's larger than half, but one of the two Palestinian, you know, occupied territories. So that by controlling the borders of the Gaza Strip, in a sense, this is their this is a way of reasserting control. And the funny thing about it is that this happened. Like, so I send the question to UNRWA's spokesperson. Like, what do you make of this? What do you say about this? Never heard of it. Ask your stringer here to look into it. And I know from Al Jazeera Arabic, they do know about the story. So I guess this may seem highly micro to you. Why would a UN agency not be screaming that a girl with a crushed organs couldn't leave the Gaza Strip?
Well, I mean, why?
I don't know.
I'm not going to speculate. I have no idea. So, are you, like, you seem to be gently suggesting because that it's because UNRWA is
wants the Palestinian Authority.
Fatah.
Oh well, yes. Oh, definitely. That's the UN position.
So,
the UN position.
Like, I mean,
Ban Ki-moon went to Gaza. He didn't meet with Hamas. Now, maybe he should, maybe he shouldn't. But there's no. The UN position is that it would be a good thing if Hamas disappeared, or the Palestinian Authority magically reestablished control over the Gaza Strip. Therefore, even a humanitarian aid effort, it's my belief, will be made to use that to have that come about. Maybe it's a good result. I mean, again, really, I have no brief for Hamas. But I do think that it's like with RTP. I do think that an agency like the UN, if nothing else, should be absolutely suffering is suffering, right? They shouldn't be in the business of saying. There another incident took place, and then I'll, and again, you can say these are very micro. There was a report that an aid truck coming in through one of the crossings from Israel, a Jordanian truck of aid, was hijacked by gunmen, and that in response to that, UNRWA suspended for a period of time other aid deliveries. The thing is that this was reported on a Palestinian wire service called MAN, MA-AN, but nothing was ever said by UNRWA. First they said they'd never heard of it. Later John Gang said, yes, they looked into it. They don't think that the truck was hijacked, but they did suspend deliveries for a full 24 hours. But they never said anything. So I go back to, now I'm going to put on my pro-Israel hat. If an Israeli attack had stopped delivery of aid, they absolutely would have spoken about it. Do you see what I mean? Now, in this case, maybe it's because when they looked into it, they don't believe the first attack happened, so they didn't say anything. But I think from the outset, they would have said it in the alternative. There sort of seems to be a selective decision of, like, and maybe it's a decision of, like, the overall story here was Israel was bombing, therefore those are the attacks on which you should focus what you say. But to me, like, you know, like, a truck diverted is a truck diverted. It's not like the politics of, like, whether which side did it come after you decide, like, we're going to report on suspensions of aid, or we're going to report on injured people not leaving a territory. You know, I don't know. I'm sorry. I've said too much.
No. I mean, it's fine. And you know, again, like you made a point earlier about sort of the Europeans and the UN and sort of everyone, you know, wanting to bolster Fatah. And you know, it's interesting to point out that one of Obama's, if not the first, call Obama made to a foreign leader was to Abbas.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, again, that's
a priority, I mean, right?
Would fall in your. Would seem sure. to you know, bolster your argument.
Yeah, no, and I don't think it's really. I mean, I guess countries are fair to have their own foreign policy. You know, their foreign policy. I almost like it's sort of like holding. Maybe it's holding the UN to a higher standard, but I think it really. And it's also even distinguishing. I understand that the UN has a Department of Political Affairs that ultimately decides, like, you know, what's the best way here? What's the way to bring about this elusive Palestinian reconciliation or whatever? Right. But it seems to me that the UN on the ground, and maybe we can both agree on this, both in delivering aid, but even in sort of providing kind of like unfiltered humanitarian reporting, you know what I mean? Like, today this happened, the crossing is open and this came through, this was stopped and these people couldn't eat. Like, these are objective. There should be no, like, whatever even the political position of the UN is, based, I guess, I mean, by what right the UN sort of, I guess it takes it from the Security Council, right? It's not up to the UN to have a foreign policy. But ultimately, it has a political strategy, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that cannot be allowed to filter down and sort of, to me, at least to me, maybe it's very subtle, but undermine the credibility of kind of the on the ground, like, this happened. Like, somebody should just be like, this happened. And I thought that's what the UN did, but I'm always being disabused of that, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, there's always, and we've talked about this before, you know, mm-hmm. this like sort of natural tension between humanitarian aid deliverers and human rights
sure.
people, with you know, human rights people wanting to sort of name and shame, and humanitarian aid people wanting to work with so they can feed the people, work with governments so
right.
they can feed the people. So you know, again, it's like, and these are always sort of very tricky, if not intractable, kind of dilemmas that international agencies have to work through.
But I almost think, I agree. There's a subset of that, which is to say, if you're going to be in the business of being a human rights defender or, you know, sort of like, you know, humanitarian, you know, truth teller, but you have to report on all of it. You can't bury some stuff because you think it's either inconvenient or it's the wrong perpetrator, right? It's like, that's why I focus on, like, the girl in the ambulance. That's just a girl in an ambulance, right?
Yeah.
It's like, if she was blocked from going through the Kerem Shalom, you know, crossing to Israel, it's huge, it's world news. If she's blocked going to Egypt, not so convenient, you know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And I just think that's a shame. The UN should really, and I think everyone could respect that. Maybe in the short term, you know, already people complain about the UN, so it's going to be complained about anyway. It could kind of have the courage of its convictions and just, like, you know, ruthlessly.
Maybe one more quick topic to broach.
I almost feel like, even though we can do the Congo, well, maybe we should. There was.
I was going to
propose Sri Lanka.
Maybe look a little too far and look at Iran and
sure.
It looks like, according to news reports and according to Susan Rice's brief statements at the stakeout, that the P5 plus one process is going to recommence.
Mm-hmm.
That being sort of the international negotiations on Iranian nuclear issues that include the P5 plus Germany,
mm-hmm.
sometimes called the EU3.
Yep.
Germany being the third member of the EU after France and the UK, and sort of when that is kicked up to the Security Council level, they call it P5 plus one, but it looks like that is going to recommence again.
Mm-hmm.
And according to excellent reporting by, and everyone should read The Cable by Laura Rosen, which mm-hmm. is a new foreign policy blog on foreignpolicy.com, the magazine that hired her, she's a former colleague of mine at The Prospect, has been doing some really great reporting on sort of who's staffing what positions
mm-hmm.
in the incoming foreign policy apparatus of the new administration. And so she reported, she suggested that they're going to assign a full-time sort of envoy to the P5 plus one process.
Mm-hmm.
So That's, I don't know. No,
definitely.
I'm wondering, have you heard percolations?
It was. People
like
were, I mean, she was, that was among the three questions that Susan Rice took at the stakeout, and yeah. Her answer was, you know, it, I mean, it seems like during the campaign, he used that, that was the example Obama says, like, we'll talk to, you know, we'll talk to anyone.
Yeah.
Then he sort of laid down this gauntlet, and I still think it's all predicated on, like, you know, as long as they agree to, you know, suspend nuclear enrichment, you know, we'll talk to them. And that seems to be the whole, the thing is that that's what you talk with them about, you know? But there definitely seems like a change in the weather. And so there's a, as with all these countries, I mean, I'm going to, not to jump around, but Russia said that they're not going to, they're going to at least delay deploying missiles that they were going to put next to Poland. You know what I mean? There's sort of like a lot of countries, a lot of the sort of like standoffs of the last, you know, the period of the Bush administration of all, every, you know, there's a new chance everywhere. Somebody, I mean, just factually speaking, they said Obama's address was shown, you know, obviously all over the world. China's apparently edited out two lines about, you know, communism and suppression of the free press.
Right,
but Iran,
right.
they said, really downplayed it. On state TV in Iran, it was like not, even though in a way it had this like outstretched arm, very much downplayed, you know?
Yeah.
So it's sort of interesting. I guess they're taking a wait-and-see approach, but there's no...
Yeah.
I mean, what's interesting is also to see, everyone's always sort of, like, buzzing. People are asking, even this guy, Mansour, the permanent observer of Palestine, like, you know, whether he's going to tell Susan Rice that, you know, they need to talk to Iran. So it's like all these little... These
well, it looks like... I mean, it looks like it's going to happen, and it looks like the administration is also poised, and maybe by the time this runs on... Sunday, the announcement will already have been made, but is poised to appoint Dennis Ross as a special envoy to Iran negotiations. Dennis Ross being a Clinton administration Middle East negotiator.
Mm-hmm. I was perusing his book only this week. I have to, again. I'm sorry to be Africa fixated, but since we've so often discussed the Congo, I just think in sort of both factually and thematically, there have been some major news since we last spoke. Which is, and the news is the kind of, and in fact, it's described in papers with not known to be UN bashers, like the Christian Science Monitor, an article that I was discussing with the Rwandan ambassador, and he liked the article a lot, said that both countries, Congo and Rwanda, lost confidence in the UN and decided to just take care of business themselves. And the business they're trying to take care of is the final either eradication or repatriation of the FDLR Hutu militias, who have been in eastern Congo since the Rwandan genocide. They've, you know, procreated and expanded, so such that the current members may well be like the children of genocide heirs, but they're hanging around. There's only about 6,000 of them, but for you know, for several years now, most, you know, both permanent five ambassadors and, you know, of the Security Council and the Department of Peacekeeping Operations, pretty much everyone was saying, like, this is the missing piece. The problem is, because it was the rationale for the Tutsi rebel, General Laurent Nkunda, to be running around with the militia. Everyone was like, this group has to go, but who's going to get them out? And the UN tried everything. They had, you know, radio stations in the hills. There was a lot of, there was talk of relocating them elsewhere in the Congo. And finally, to the surprise of many people, Congo and Rwanda reached an agreement by which Rwandan troops could enter the Congo and engage with FDLR, meaning, you know, basically threaten to wipe them out militarily or drive them back into Rwanda. And sort of,
but, right, instead of engaging with the FDLR, what do?
Well, they blocked the UN. The UN suddenly got blocked.
Well, I'm saying they arrested Nkunda.
They did both. No, these two things are totally related. In fact, the Rwandan ambassador said there's no contradiction. The idea is that all these problems were connected. They, once they were allowed in themselves to take care of the FDLR, the sort of the rationale for having what was many people described as a Rwandan proxy militia of Nkunda was gone. Plus, I think
One question I have for you is that, you know, last time we talked, you talked about this UN report, this sort of no-nonsense Security Council report that described in pretty fine detail the
support,
the financial relationship between the government of Rwanda and Laurent Nkunda, and the conclusion was that Nkunda was basically a front for Rwandan business interests in eastern Congo. And now, you know, I read last week, and you know, I saw the news reports, as did you, that Rwandan government troops essentially surrounded Nkunda, forced him into Rwanda, and arrested him.
Let's back up. Oh no, let's back up. Even the Rwandans say he's not under arrest. He's in a safe location. He's actually in a very fine house in Jisenyi. And according to the Rwandans,
some sort of house detention.
It's a very nice house, by the way.
He's no longer the military leader of the was it the CNDP?
CNDP,
in,
correct. And the irony
in
is
Eastern Congo. His, right, right. So the guy that the Rwandans were backing,
sure.
The Rwandans
is
have
now in semi.
Him, I want to know. I want to know why.
That's the whole nitty gritty. I actually think I will go as far as to say that. And again, when the report came out, I think I remember telling you it was one of the finest pieces of UN work I've seen since I've been here. It had even though Rwanda contested it, and even to this day is saying, like, you know, a lot of that's in it is irrelevant. I think that really kind of shamed the Rwandans. Like, it made it, like, now Nkunda and their connection to, and their, at least their business people's connection to him was a liability, internationally and otherwise. And I think then all the pieces fell into place. I don't think there's any way that they would have detained or even like slowed down Nkunda if they hadn't gotten this agreement to themselves go after the FDLR. But it all kind of worked together. I think the word arrest is the wrong word, at least according to the Rwandans. He's not under arrest. He is detained in a very nice house. It's kind of like a Diane Fossey, you know, like nice village. There are some very nice places in that part of Rwanda where people...
The point is, though, that he's no longer the militia leader in eastern Congo that the Rwandan...
If you remember, he was being overthrown well before the Rwandans picked him up. They were his number two, known as Bosco Ntaganda, who is, in fact, an indicted war criminal by the ICC, announced that Nkunda was being overthrown and kept saying, I'm the new leader. And Nkunda said he wasn't the leader. We kept asking the UN, who are you dealing with? As it turned out, then Nkunda hit the road, was picked up by Rwandans and put into this beautiful villa. Bosco turned over all of his troops, of the remaining troops of the CNDP, it was reported, to be integrated into the Congolese army. Now the question became, what's going to happen to Bosco? Because he's indicted. In the same way that Joseph Kony's indicted and Bashir may be indicted, Bosco is already indicted. So the question became, how can the UN, if right now Bosco is not under arrest anywhere, right? The Congolese government has not arrested him, and there's some back and forth whether the CNDP has actually integrated into the army, but it seems very clear that Bosco made a deal. There is a deal made. When you're an indicted war criminal that can be taken to The Hague, you don't just go to a government and say, here, take my guns, right? So the idea
is the government agrees not to extradite him, then.
I guess that's the deal. But the question is, if they put him into the army, can the UN peacekeeping mission continue to work as it says under the Security Council resolutions with a military that has as a member an indicted war criminal, right? If it happened in Sudan, they'd be screaming. But I guess in the Congo, things are different.
So I don't know. Is he going to remain a commander? Is he going to sort of ride
his memoirs?
Horse off into the
We're waiting for the Bosco memoirs.
I guess we'll have
no,
to
that
see
was what, that's really the question. I've tried to ask it here and there. Everyone's sort of dodging the Bosco question. But it is the worst thing, and this is, again, it's not to be a UN basher. It's to say, what's going on? There was a period of at least, you know, some days. The Indian peacekeepers that tried to accompany or at least, you know, go in the wake of the Congolese army as they worked with Rwandans to rout the FARDC, the FDLR, were told, you can't come. This was a big thing. And this was, I talked to the head of peacekeeping, Alain Leroy. He said, yes, this happened. We're trying to work through it. It's highly ironic because, under the Security Council resolution, MONUC, the peacekeeping mission, is supposed to protect civilians. Clearly, you can't do it if you don't have access to the terrain, right?
Uh-huh.
So suddenly, the UN started, working feverishly. At the same time, they were pointing out that they weren't part of the assault, that they played no part in the planning. Only today they've announced that they will now be providing logistical support to the Rwandans and the Congolese. But they're not part of the attack, but they'll be providing logistics. To cynics such as myself, it appears as sort of an 11th hour attempt to remain relevant. Like, I mean, here's a direct quote. The Rwandan ambassador said to me yesterday, the UN was always complaining about what Rwanda was doing and about the FDLR, but did nothing. Now it's being taken care of, and what's the UN doing? Complaining. That's a quote. And I think maybe what he means is there. If the UN were complaining in order to get access to protect civilians, I'm all for it. If they're complaining that sort of like, wow, despite spending $2 billion, despite many meetings, when the action finally happens, they're not even part of the party, that's a kind of pathetic. So which do you think it is, Mark?
I don't know. I can't.
I'm sorry.
I can't get into their head. You do that a lot, actually. You make me sort of have to.
I know. I'm sorry. It's wildly unfair, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like it's. Yeah. I mean, I guess.
Well, listen. I mean, like the thing about MONUC is that it's sort of like a peacekeeping a mission unlike any others because it does more. Like, first of all, there's not too much of a peace to keep there. So it does. actual sort of like war fighting, right? Which is pretty unheard of for the UN to do. This is like this is kind of brand new territory for the UN. And to a certain extent, the mission in Haiti was similar,
right,
where they actually go on sort of proactive missions as opposed to just sort of putting international troops between two warring parties.
Sure.
They actually are fighting against people. And you know, this is not like a national army. These are internationals. These are, you know, UN.
Isn't it, they're not mixed, though. Be aware, like, all the Indians work together, all the Pakistanis work together, right? I mean, the Indians control North Kivu.
Uruguayans,
the Pakistanis, right.
You know, there are a lot, yeah, sure. I mean, there are a lot of different nationalities there. But the point is, they're not, you know, it's not like an invading. It's like that they have sort of a new and as to yet, like, a still defining role,
mm-hmm,
as sort of aggressive peacekeepers. It's sort of like, what isn't the term they use in the UN system? It's like Chapter 6 plus,
right?
Right.
Right.
Is that what it is? It's this idea that, you know, you're not quite just the buffers that traditional peacekeepers are, but you actually, you know, do go out and do sort of impose peace, as opposed to simply keep peace.
They haven't been doing a lot of it, but yeah. No, absolutely. That's
so,
right.
So, I mean, that's like the view from the sky, I suppose.
Right, but I guess it's something, and maybe this is the better point, which is just that if the UN has been spending $2 billion a year in the Congo, it seems like they have some sway. They should have been able to say to Joseph Kabila and the FARDC, you have to let us in, right? I mean, it seems very strange. It seems highly dubious that you get barred. You know, and the thing about the FDR.
But when you say they're spending $2 billion in the Congo, they're not.
That's the budget.
$2
billion
is what it costs to deploy the mission.
Right.
It's not like they are walking around with bags of money to give
right,
to
right.
the president.
No, I understand.
You know.
But I mean, let's say the UN system has been pretty good to Joseph Kabila. It has. The ICC has indicted most of his enemies, including the number two candidate in the last election, right?
Yeah.
The UN peacekeepers are willing to ferry ammunition and food to his army, whoever they happen to be fighting at the moment. And then, when despite all that, when they go in, and the FDLR, you know, they may be like ruthless genocidaires, but they also have women. There's women and children there too. You know, when they actually move in on them, they say, "Sorry, UN, can't come this time." You know, that's a problem. Wouldn't you say? I mean, I think like, and then you know, it's been and what the reaction by the Security Council has been disappointing. The UK ambassador John Soares said, "Well, you know, it's true there's some irregularities, but on balance, this is very good news. And you can't sort of like you can't accomplish something without a few irregularities." Now let's go back to talking about Gaza. It's kind of like there seems to be kind of a. I mean, it's a big deal when the UN peacekeeping mission, which has been specifically mandated to protect civilians, is barred by the government it's supposed to be working with from doing just that, right? I mean, it's one thing if the UN peacekeepers are sleeping in their base or don't go outside or let people, like, die at the fence. I'm sorry to be unfair. But it's something altogether different where a government that you're working with says, don't come on this raid. Right? I don't know. That's all. But, I mean, we'll see. That one, it's been fast-moving events, and there's no question that things are probably at least in a more promising place. You know, things could go wrong, of course, but they are in a more promising place now than they were 3 weeks ago. You know,
this is true, and you know, like, you know, we've talked about. I'm really glad that we keep talking about this because not many people do.
Yeah, I know.
Talk about this.
We do it at the end, so the viewers can, if they choose to turn away, they can. But the Congo, it really is a country that
well,
needs
it. Well, it really is like the bloodiest war in the world, and the bloodiest war of the 21st century. So
no, and that's also why I have to say the idea. I mean, again, it's not to be in any way be dismissive of what's happening.
Yeah.
Certainly in the past, but even currently in Sudan. But it just seems sometimes when it's like what you know, or even. All the focus, I mean, the killer was they did these press conferences on Gaza day after day, such that they even canceled their press conferences on any other topic. I'm not kidding you.
Yeah,
so I had to ask it, the humanitarian guy, John Holmes. I'm like, what about, you know, the attack on the LRA that's now, they're rampaging and have killed 500 people in northern, and the deputy spokeswoman says, I'm sorry, this briefing is only about Gaza. And it's like there's no other briefing.
So
it's sort of like
I'm glad we're waving the flag, Matthew. Until next time.
Okay. Enough is enough.
All right. Thank you.
Sure.
And have a well, I guess it's only we're recording this on a Wednesday. I usually wish you a good weekend.
No. There's the action. The action is hot and heavy over here. You know.
All right.